This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. College campus activism came alive in the 1960s to oppose the Vietnam War. It happened again in the 1980s with a divestment campaign aimed at ending apartheid in South Africa. Today, a new generation of college activists is mobilizing to stop climate change. Their tactic is to demand that university endowment funds shed their coal, oil, and gas stocks.
Students at dozens of universities across the country, including Harvard, are making the demand. Divest from fossil fuel companies that they say are recklessly contributing to global warming. To date, two small schools, Unity College in Maine and Hampshire College in Massachusetts, have agreed to shed their fossil fuel stocks. But will the movement grow?
If Bill McKibben has anything to say about it, the answer is yes.
As of tonight, we're going after the fossil fuel industry.
So that's Bill McKibben at a recent rally in Boston. The writer-turned-environmental activist has been rallying college campuses, speaking at sold-out events, and urging students to start divestment campaigns aimed at some 200 energy companies.
So listeners, do you think it will work? Can college campus divestment activism help slow global warming in the same way it fueled the anti-apartheid debate? Should Harvard and other universities rid their endowments of energy company stocks, or should endowments be first and foremost about building wealth and supporting the academic mission? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston.
And joining us now from Vermont is Bill McKibben. He's the author of dozens of books about the environment, including The End of Nature. He's also the founder of the grassroots group 350.org. And welcome back to Radio Boston, Bill McKibben. So great to have you.
It's always good to be with you all.
Also with us is Bob Massey. He's president and CEO of the New Economics Institute in Cambridge. He was active in the South African divestment movement back in the 1980s. And Bob Massey, great to see you in here. Thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
Also with us is Chloe Maxman. She's a sophomore at Harvard University from Midcoast, Maine. She's the co-coordinator of Divest Harvard. And good to have you, Chloe Maxman. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Bill McKibben, let me start with you. Why divestment? Why college campuses?
Well, look, we have a real problem here, which is that for 25 years, we've gotten no action on climate change in any serious way. Not because we don't know the science, it's because the politics are out of whack. And the reason the politics are out of whack is that the fossil fuel industry exerts endless power. What we're trying to get across to people now is that this is a rogue industry. I wrote a long piece for Rolling Stone this summer that went oddly viral and became the subtext for this huge sold-out tour of America we finished yesterday, 22 sold-out houses across the country and since the election. What they showed was that the fossil fuel industry has five times as much carbon in its reserves as the most conservative government on Earth says would be safe to burn. They're a rogue industry. The tobacco industry killed us one by one. The fossil fuel industry is determined to take down the whole planet. So we're going to try and turn them into the tobacco industry, try to weaken some of that political power, try to put their share price under pressure, try to use the kind of tactics that people like Bob used so effectively against businesses that worked with South Africa.
And sort of the end game of this of your strategy, because Bill McKibben, you're known for sort of careful strategy. What's the goal here? I mean, is the best case to shut these companies down or change their behaviors?
No, the best case is to open up some political space so that we can make the changes that every economist has said we need to make for a quarter century, put a price on carbon, that kind of thing. At which point, these companies will decide to become energy companies, not fossil fuel companies. I mean, Exxon alone spends $100 million every day searching for new hydrocarbons. That $100 million a day would put up an awful lot of solar panels if that's what they were in the business of instead.
Now, as we mentioned, you've been touring the country, bringing this message to college campuses. To date, two very small colleges, Unity College in Maine and Hampshire College in Massachusetts, have agreed to shed their energy stocks. But as the New York Times reported today in a great piece that I recommend, actually, quote, at colleges with large endowments, many administrators are skeptical, saying it would undermine their goal of maximum returns in support of education. What do you say to that?
I think we're in early days, and the fight is going great. In 3 weeks, we've managed to spread to 146 campuses across the country. Of course, administrators are going to say no first, just mm-hmm. like they did at Harvard last week. I mean, it's inconvenient. As Al Gore said, there are a lot of inconvenient things about all of this problem. It's inconvenient for them to have to deal with it. But students, faculty, alumni will make sure they have to deal with it. And truthfully, I think, you know, Chloe and others are showing that we can do that, you know, that we're going to be able to do this. Most colleges in America have proclaimed their commitment loud and clear to sustainability. They've built energy efficient buildings. They have web pages all about how they're greening the campus. If you're going to green the campus, then logically you should be greening the portfolio too. I'll tell you one good New England piece of data. Yesterday, Middlebury, the college where I hang out, announced that they're going to have a consultative campus-wide procedure in January. They're bringing together all the investment advisors. They're bringing together the number of students and faculty who want change, and they're going to talk the whole thing out. I think we're going to see a lot of that, partly because, you know, the generation of college administrators and board members today, they were in school when people like Bob were helping run this apartheid divestment movement a quarter century ago. Once in a while, you come up against these insurmountable moral challenges, and you've got to do the right thing.
Well, you mentioned Bob Massey, and he's here in the studio, as well as Chloe Maxman. And let me start with you, Chloe. So last month, some 2,600 Harvard undergraduates voted in support of a referendum calling on the university to divest from the fossil fuel industry. That represented 72% of the student vote. Why is this important to you and to all those students who voted in favor of this?
I think that students are realizing that climate change is a serious issue that is going to affect our future, and our political system has not been able to enact significant legislation that will curb carbon emissions, and we're grabbing on to divestment as a new way to fight the fossil fuel industry and take hold of our future. And this realization is really just coming into the student consciousness as things like Hurricane Sandy and all of the droughts over the summer have been impacting our personal lives. And we want our university to draw more line in the sand. Harvard has green buildings. We have 14 geothermal wells. We have significant commitments to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, yet we're supporting companies that are threatening our future.
Now, Harvard told the New York Times in that piece that I mentioned this morning, quote, "We always appreciate hearing from our students, but we are not considering divestment from companies related to fossil fuels. We invited a representative from Harvard on this show. They declined. They did refer us to a statement from the Harvard Management Corporation, which manages the endowment. And the statement says, our singular mission is to generate strong long-term investment returns to support the educational and research goals of the universities. It went on to say that in evaluating investments, Harvard says that it considers issues related to environment, labor practices, and corporate governance. Your response to that?
We can see through Harvard's public SEC filings that we're invested in companies like Vale, which is a mining company, and Petrobras, which is an offshore oil driller company that's on the list of the top 200 fossil fuel companies that we're trying to invest from. And I don't think that those fall into the ESG criteria. And so we're very open to learning what that screening process is like so that we can strengthen it so that we're not investing in these kinds of companies. And Divest Harvard has been working for almost a month to get a meeting with President Faust, because we have 1,000 student signatures that we would like to deliver to her, and we also want to lay out our campaign and discuss the results of the referendum.
And what have you heard from President Faust?
There has been no response until today, when we learned that next semester we will be able to meet with our Corporation Committee on Shareholder Responsibility, which is a major governing body on these issues, and so that's a major step forward.
Now, Bob Massey, I want to come over to you, because you were active, as we mentioned, in the divestment movement in the 1980s, targeting South Africa's apartheid regime. You wrote about this. You wrote a book called Loosing the Bonds, the U.S. and South Africa in the Apartheid Years. There was a lot of debate about this back then. What parallels do you see with this nascent movement?
Well, I think at the beginning, everyone thought that this was a technique, a position that would not have an effect. And yet, student after student, group after group, began to have these internal debates about whether it was really consistent for them to be benefiting financially from corporations that violated the most fundamental principles by which for which they were established. It was very interesting just to comment on the statement you got from the Harvard Management Company that they were interested in long-term investment for the educational purposes. I think there are two inconsistencies in one short phrase. First of all, there is no long-term bright future for us if we are engulfed by climate change, so that this is a bad risk fundamentally from their own perspective. And also, just from a very basic question of mission, Harvard University is supposed to be investing in our future, supporting students, enabling a better future. And in fact, what the fossil fuel companies are companies whose business model is to wreck it. Now, back in South Africa, one of the things we learned is that individual actions accrued over time, changed institutions' behavior. Those institutions, in turn, changed the political climate. And so, actually, back in the 1980s, when people thought there was no chance for the United States Congress to do anything, they had dragged their heels for years, eventually the Congress rose up, took actions. President Reagan at the time vetoed those actions, and a Republican Senate overrode his veto because of public pressure on the Senate and actually took substantive steps. So this is a pathway to making change.
How effective is it? I mean, as you know, I mean, I know you're an advocate of it, but there is debate about how effective it was. And even back then, there were questions about how much of an effect it would actually have on companies doing business in South Africa. Do you see this as, can this really exert the kind of influence on these energy companies today?
Well, I think it depends on what you mean by effectiveness. I mean, companies work very, very hard to portray themselves in a certain light and to present themselves as people who are contributing to our better life. If people start to realize that these are companies whose business model is really contradictory to a better future, then they increasingly have to explain themselves. If people dump enough stock, their stock value does go down. And then you risk all kinds of other things. In the South African case, cities started to refuse to buy products from companies that were operating in South Africa. So the political pressure rose dramatically on those firms, and they eventually changed their behavior.
Bill McKibben.
Just the people who said it wasn't going to be ineffective, wasn't going to be effective, were the people who didn't want to be bothered to do it. The people who really knew, say, Nelson Mandela, when he got out of prison, one of the first trips he took was to the U.S., and he did not go first to the White House. He went first to the University of California to thank students there who had forced the divestment of $3 billion worth of stock. For the people in the trenches in the fights, it was effective as can be, and it'll be effective again if we work as hard as people did back then.
I'm wondering, one of the significant differences between this sort of nascent effort on your part, Bill McKibben, and what was happening in the 1980s. And actually, let me ask you this, Bob Massey. You know, the divestment campaign back in the 80s was aimed at another country's policies. This effort is aimed at changing policies here. And I'm just wondering to what extent that sort of changes the tactics, the thinking about the tactics and so forth.
Well, back in the 1980s, people thought there was less chance that people would actually take steps because South Africa was so far away, and it seemed something that most people weren't going to be concerned about. There's an argument that we could make that given this is about our own community, our own country, our own coastal communities that were wiped out by Sandy, and the prospect that this is going to intensify more and more and more without any changes unless we see real action in the U.S. Congress. I think, in fact, it's likely that more and more people will get the message and get it quickly. I was very struck. The South African movement took several years to get going. But in a viral age of internet connection and the kind of work that 350 and Bill and Chloe are doing, we're seeing this develop very fast in relation to the prior experience.
Are you seeing that, Chloe? I mean, is there a sense that this is sort of taking off in a very fast way?
Yes, absolutely. A few months ago, there were a dozen schools working on divestment, and now there's almost 150. And within campuses and across the country, it has spread like wildfire, in large part due to Facebook and Twitter and 350's coordination efforts.
And let me ask you this. The anti-divestment campaign over apartheid ended up escalating in a big way. It eventually included sit-ins, hunger strikes, occupation of campus buildings. Do you advocate that kind of activism? Do you think the movement will go there at Harvard or elsewhere?
I think that the movement might get to a stage where more direct action is needed. But right now, we haven't even had an opportunity to meet with an administrator. And we want to have an open dialogue about this issue. We want to help our administration divest from fossil fuels. And we want to build a coalition of responsibility among faculty and staff and students and alumni to bring this issue into the forefront of campus and national dialogue.
So listeners, we're asking what you think. Can college campus divestment activism actually help stop global warming in the same way it fueled that anti-apartheid debate more than a generation ago? Give us a call. Join the conversation, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's take a couple of calls. Steve is calling from Cambridge. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
I think to some degree Bill McKibben and Chloe have it backwards. It's very easy to demonize industries and corporations, but they are supplying something that consumers and Harvard students and the like are demanding. They want more cars. They want to use jet travel to get from here and there. They want to have unlimited electronic devices that are very, very hard on the environment and use a lot of electricity. I mean, it's very easy to say the fossil fuel industry is the cause when actually it's the public's behavior and consumption that is really the problem.
Let me take a crack at
Bill McKibben. Steve's making the point that the problem, not the companies.
So it's a kind of obvious point, and of course it's one that everybody's been working on for a very long time. And we've made some real strides. Places like Harvard are starting to do a good job of trying to cut use. But most people, though we're all complicit in climate change because the way the world's set up right now, we don't have much choice but to use some fossil fuel. Most of us don't care at all if our power came instead from, say, the sun and the wind. In fact, we'd probably prefer it. We look at countries like Germany that are nearing 50% of their power coming from renewable sources, and we look at them with envy. The only people who have a vested interest in keeping us addicted to our current means of supply are the people who own oil wells and coal mines. And that's why they've fought so hard in Congress and elsewhere to make sure that nothing ever changes. And that's why we've got to take them on. Unless we can weaken that political position, we're never going to see the kind of change that we need and the kind of change that, contrary to the caller, most people would very much welcome.
Well, I'd like to add just one quick thing.
Please.
The work that we're doing at the New Economics Institute actually supports some of the things Steve is saying, which is that Americans right now are restless. They want to see new forms of agriculture, new forms of energy use, new forms of consumption. They want to discuss whether endless growth is appropriate for our economy for other environmental reasons. So Steve's not entirely wrong. I mean, there is a puzzle there and it needs to be worked out. But I completely agree with Bill that in the face of a really disgraceful failure by the United States government to address this issue, partly induced by the political power of these firms, the firms are appropriate as targets for our concern and our criticism.
Let me, the American Petroleum Institute makes the point that continued use of fossil fuels are essential for the country's economy and that energy companies are investing in cleaner energy production. If you hit these companies with divestment, aren't you hindering those efforts as well, Bill McKibben?
They're not investing in renewable energy. In fact, they're doing just the opposite. You'll recall 10 years ago, BP announced that its initials were now going to stand for Beyond Petroleum. They spent most of their money investing in a new logo, you know, but even the small amount they spent on sun and wind, they sold off those divisions a couple of years ago so that they could concentrate, as they put it, on their core business. Exactly the same thing happened at Shell. They sold off their sun and wind investments. These guys make the most tiny and minor concessionary investments. Meanwhile, they pour huge, unprecedented amounts of money into looking for more hydrocarbons. We have five times more coal and gas and oil than anyone. The World Bank, the International Energy Agency says we could safely burn. And yet, what are they doing? I mean, they melted the Arctic, and their first impulse was to say, that's great, let's go up there and drill for yet more oil.
Let's go to Rama. She's calling from he's calling from Newburyport. Rama, you're on the air.
Hello, Anthony. Nice to talk to you again. And hello, Bill, and hello, Bob. Thank you for this subject. Never underestimate the ability of a small group of citizens to change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. We all know who said that, Margaret Mead. Stephen, who called Luwago, is, yes, spot on. Bill is also spot on. Now, when Steve says this, does that mean he doesn't want us to do anything? When the people that say no solar, no BUP, because it's not at a certain level yet, does that mean we don't do anything yet? Yes, it may just be a drop in the bucket. All these things are drops in the bucket, but a lot of drops fill up a lot of buckets.
So, Rama, is your point that individuals, while going after the corporations makes sense, individuals also have to take responsibility for this, too?
Yes, we do, and I do my best, and it leads me to a question I almost forgot. What can Bill and Bob and you advise someone like myself? I have a 401k. I don't have a ton of money in the bank, but what can I do? It's a J.P. Morgan Chase-managed 401k. What can I do to affect some change in that? What can I do to affect some change in daily choices that I make? What can I do, and what can some of your listeners do to really help the cause that Harvard students are doing?
Got it, Rama. Bob Massey.
First thing you can do is you can call up your company and ask them if they have a fossil-free portfolio that you can invest in. Now, the answer is almost certainly going to be no, but I can tell you in the South Africa case, when enough people asked about this and when enough institutions asked about this, put enough money on the table, suddenly those investment companies that had said it would be a disaster to have a South Africa-free portfolio suddenly created them and said, we're the best people to manage them. Hmm. And so there are some firms, investment firms, that already have these. I think we need to see more firms, and also they will demonstrate that you can get adequate returns without having to have a heavy fossil fuel component.
Bill McKibben, do you want to add to that? I mean, for the small investor with a 401k, what can he or she do?
That's exactly the right advice. Call up and say, I want this product. Please make it available, a fossil-free portfolio. But for the moment, the most useful thing you can do, since we're talking about visible action that causes political change, the most useful thing you can do is go to the place, say, where you graduated from college and join in the effort. At gofossilfree.org, you can easily sign up across the whole long list of 150 colleges that Chloe was talking about. I am a Harvard alum, and I'm incredibly proud of the work that Chloe and others are doing there. And it's absolutely in the best tradition of Harvard. Look, it's places like Harvard, and it's really one of the leaders, that taught us what we know about global warming. It's in those labs and research centers and stuff that we figured out what it all meant. And therefore, it's exactly the right place to be doing this work. If it wasn't, I mean, it's almost like, why even bother doing the research? Why bother having the classes and teaching the work if you're not going to follow up on their obvious implications?
We've got a lot more callers in line, so I want to try to get through at least two or three more. Let's go to Paul, who's calling from Cambridge. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. My point, having come through the South African divestment issue when I was in college, is that the contention was always that when someone divests, they lose the ability to have a voice in the function of the companies from whom they divest. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I haven't heard that issue in this discussion. The other point that occurs to me is that I just happen to have worked at nonprofit institutions, educational institutions, for 25 years. And I have come around to feeling that institutions such as Harvard, which have uncalculated wealth and the ability to manage it and far exceed the market returns that most institutions can achieve, are simply not doing enough with their wealth to change the face of the globe and to affect issues such as global warming. I mean,
Paul, you put two great points on the table, and our time is tight. So I want to put that point, to the first point you made, Bob, to Bob Massey, this concern about losing a voice in the company that you want to influence because of divestment.
Well, I think, first of all, everyone and every institution should really ask themselves, am I comfortable profiting from a corporation which is determined to damage the planet? So I think divestment is really the right way to go. However, in the South African question, we did have some people like the Republican state treasurer of New York, Ned Regan, who said, for various reasons, I'm not going to divest, but what I am going to do is show up with my $30 or $40 billion fund at every annual meeting of big companies in order to demand that they change. That became something that definitely got the attention of certain large companies at that time. So the most important thing is, I mean, if you hold on to the stock, you have to use your voice. The better thing is to divest the stock. The worst thing is to hold on to the stock and do absolutely nothing. Then you're mimicking the U.S. government, and that's just going to push us right off this environmental cliff.
I'm interested, Chloe, let me bring you back into this conversation. Harvard has the largest endowment, as we know, of any American university at more than $30 billion. Do we even know how much money they have invested in the energy industry?
We don't know. We can see about $1 billion worth of Harvard's investments through public SEC filings that are under the Harvard Management Company's name. And in those filings, we can see that we're invested in many fossil fuel companies, one of which, Petrobras, is on the top 200 publicly traded companies that we're asking to divest from. The rest of Harvard's endowment is not transparent or is invested through hedge and mutual funds, and we can't see.
Bob Massey, you know, seeing you and Chloe sitting here side by side, I want to ask this question. What are the limitations of the divestment campaign? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is what are the cautions maybe that you have for Chloe as someone who went through a similar struggle back in the 80s? I mean, what's your advice to her?
Well, I think it's important to realize, as Chloe clearly does, that divestment is a step in the process. It's a tactic. It's a way of creating discussion and debate inside organizations that, as Bill said earlier, would just as soon rather not discuss this. But it has to lead in a certain direction. And part of the direction, as I think we all know, is that our markets here are fundamentally failing. We need government to step in and realign markets so that the real costs of carbon are reflected in the price. That's something government has proposed over and again, but it keeps failing. So I think that it would be a danger to fall into saying divestment all by itself is going to solve climate change. It's not. But it definitely will force people to think through things and to debate things that they otherwise wouldn't talk about.
And Bill McKibben, I'm really curious to ask you this. What are you seeing and sort of picking up in terms of the energy on college campuses in your efforts here? Because sometimes this generation of college students, unfairly perhaps, described as less politically active and engaged than say, back in the 60s. What's your view of this? What have you been seeing and absorbing?
I have been astonished, really, across the country to see how fast this has taken off. Look, Chloe's an exemplar, but don't think it's just Harvard students that understand or get this. It has taken off in every corner of the country. Every place we went, we'd do these shows, and the next day there'd be 10 campuses in that region where suddenly there were hundreds of students involved in this fight. UNH, they've put 1,000 signatures in petition, and they've been outside the president's office. Brown, they had the largest rally they've had in years on the quad the other day. Hampshire and Unity have already managed to get it done, to win divestment. Middlebury, as I said, just looking around New England, the concerted effort has been enough to produce a very responsible reaction from the administration, who clearly are taking this on in the right tone and with the right seriousness.
Well, we'll continue to follow your efforts with interest. Bill McKibben, writer turned environmental activist, founder of the grassroots group 350.org. Thank you so much for joining us today. Fascinating discussion. We appreciate it. And Chloe Maxman, sophomore at Harvard, coordinator of Divest Harvard. Chloe, thanks for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Bob Massey, president and CEO of the New Economics Institute in Cambridge. Great pleasure to have you in as well. Thank you very much.
Delighted to be here.
Listeners, stay with us. The conversation continues at RadioBoston.org on this issue. And coming up, Only a Game's Bill Littlefield on the Red Sox recent high-profile signings and on the possibility that the Bruins may take the ice at the Garden sometime this season after all. I'm Anthony Brooks with Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.